This is the I Read Comic Books podcast, the very best podcast for regular comic book fans. I'm your host, Mike Rappin, and joining me this week, a truly devious fiend from the Book of Necessary Monsters, Nick White.
Hey, everyone.
Today, we're here to talk about one thing and one thing only, and that is Ice Cream Man Volume 9. So before we get started, I just got to say, full spoilers, if you're on Volume 9 of Ice Cream Man, maybe you should finish reading it, then come back. We're going to be talking about that all day today. We're going to go through each issue, we're going to break it down, get through some of our, you know, conspiratorial thoughts about how this series has gone, because this is a very lore-filled volume as far as I'm concerned. What does lore even mean in Ice Cream Man? I don't know. But anyways, we're going to dive right into it. So, Nick, I guess the first thing I'm going to say is, maybe we should talk about who actually worked on this book. And that'd be W. Maxwell Prince on writing, pencils and inks by Martin Morazzo, colors by Chris O'Halloran, letters by Good Old Neon. Nick, I'm going to kick over to you. What were your overall thoughts about this before we dive into the issue by issue breakdown here?
Yeah. Overall, for me, as a cohesive set, I felt that it was actually stronger than some of the last few volumes that we've dug into. The issues feel pretty strongly interrelated to one another. And again, like, it's been a while since we read the last volumes. Maybe this is just recency bias, but that's just my gut feeling. Mm-hmm. Things feel more cohesive. And on top of that, it also feels like, for the first time in a while, that maybe this series is picking up a little steam, getting a little narrative arc momentum, and it's gearing up to go somewhere for the first time in maybe a couple years.
Yes. Well, it's so funny that you say
which
that.
Which is not an insult. This book has done what it's wanted to do often than not, and I think that's been fine. But it does feel like it's really gearing off in a certain direction again.
Yeah. I think the last two volumes that we've discussed, I think we've said, you know, where's the Ice Cream Man? Where is Caleb? Where's this story that I think W. Maxwell Prince and everybody else working on this book, they've been building up kind of in the background, maybe as the main story, maybe as a side story. We kind of just didn't see Caleb in specific for a long time. And I think there was a narrative moment that kind of maybe explained that we didn't really know how to judge until we suddenly didn't see this character in the story anymore. But I specifically feel like volume 7 and 8 did not really have much. I call this quote unquote lore building, but you know, Ice Cream Man, the lore is such a weird thing to consider, given that this is truly an anthology series that has a theme that connects it. And yet Morazzo and Prince have like inserted this thing between a character named Caleb and a character named Ice Cream Man and or Ricardus, however you want to call it. Right. And they're in this sort of battle. And I think maybe I'm leading into what we're going to be talking about in the issue 34, because this issue is 33 through 36. And yeah, we get a little bit more of that. And I think you and I have been kind of clamoring for that, so, which makes me think maybe we should just dive into this so we can start to talk about those specifics. So how about you kick us off and tell us what issue 33 was about, the kind of story I want to write.
Sure. And I would also say broadly, I think 33, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
33, I would say broadly, also kind of sets the trajectory and theme for the arc at large outside of 36, which feels like an outlier, and we'll get there eventually. And
yeah,
it's hard to easily wrap that one in with the other three, but so 33 is sort of this story where W. Maxwell Prince, or this narrator or author character that we've seen before that, looks an awful lot like W. Maxwell Prince, seems to have certain tendencies or interests or whatnot that align with some of the things that we've read about W. Maxwell Prince as a person. Again, whether this is literally meant to be him or some kind of just comparable, you know, stand-in, we're not sure. But the writ large idea of this issue is that Prince, or this author, whichever you want to go with, discusses the fact that he's aware that most of his issues tend to be grim, they tend to be dark, they tend to go into not so nice places, and that if he had the choice, he would be writing issues that are much more bright and upbeat, and they have a hero, and there's a learning, and there's a hero's journey, and everyone's happy at the end, and there's sunshine and rainbows, credits roll. But that's just not the sort of story he tells.
Yeah.
And he does this by going through, does he call the character, is it Bob or Bill? But he goes through and basically shows us the story he wants to tell. And he shows us a story he inevitably tells, by way of going through this one guy's just day-to-day existence.
Yeah, and we get this back and forth narrative of the good story versus the story that the author usually tells. The character's name is Brad. I just switched through the pages. This is such an interesting thing because again, I said this in my notes. I really hope this issue isn't like a cry for help by any means, you know, because there really seems to be. I think we've seen this in the past with other stories that seem to be about this author or about W. Maxwell Prince directly, because I think Prince has like inserted himself into the story a couple of times now, either through here or through the Quarantine Comics issues. Right. And there seems to be this like almost beat down of self where Prince doesn't necessarily like what he's doing, or the author doesn't necessarily like what they're doing, and yet they have to get them out because this is the type of story that they're going to tell. There isn't a reason behind it other than this is the type of story I have to tell, or that is being told by me. Sorry, that's it. And I liked how this issue opened with this idea of like, I want to tell these stories that are dynamic and bright, kind of like you said. And then we cut to the other half of the page, which is Ice Cream Man and like the Memory Goblin and all these awful creatures that we've met over the series. You know, to be 33 issues into this series, and W. Maxwell Prince is saying, I've created monsters and I don't know what to do about it. it's such a funny idea.
Yeah, I mean, in his words, he basically says, you know, the whole thing, parentheses, the story, seems just totally obsessed with the endless pain and suffering of sick, broken people. Mm-hmm, and I gotta be honest, maybe it was especially the last two volumes seemed to be pretty dark and didn't always have kind of a silver lining. And maybe he's just decided that like now is the time to put in this issue. Finally, maybe he feels like people have maybe reached that breaking point, and he's like, "Look, guys, like I'm aware of what's going on. Like I know that I have tendencies, in terms of my narrative interests, and you know I'm aware of it, and I'm sorry."
But you know, the interesting thing that about this issue is it reminded me of the Strange Neapolitan issue, right? With the three lines that separated kind of like three parallel universes. And this is kind of what we're getting in this specific triptych issue, you know? Triptych, that's what it was. Sorry, that's from the Strange Neapolitan volume. That's right. I got it. But it's split up into three colors, which made me think ice cream, so don't blame me.
No.
But I like how this, he takes this idea, this theme, and kind of like twists it instead of doing three parallel lines. And I think that issue was maybe more than that. But we get this like very split top and bottom as the series goes on as the issue goes on. And we see, you know, even full page flops, which means, you know, Morazzo's redrawing things or reusing pieces of their art over and over, which is so cool to me. Like to say that color and a little bit of context can give some of the exact or almost exact panels so much more meaning and power. It's so impressive. Like again, this is where this series kind of shines, in that the team not only gets to tell these dark, kind of sometimes gross stories, sometimes just I don't know, skin crawling stories, but they also get to play with the medium in a way that not a lot of other books I think get the ability to, because their stories are so like unique issue to issue. I don't know, that was like my big takeaway. I didn't feel like this was a necessarily like profound issue beyond some of the implications of like this dark thing that haunts all of my stories, which is Ice Cream Man, is kind of just ever present and I can't do anything about it. But I did like that bit.
Yeah, for me it was really, as you said, like it's largely the same image, but it's tweaked and twisted, and I think that only makes it more unsettling, that it's similar but it's not exactly the same. Big credit to Chris O'Halloran. I think it would have been easy to do like the bad story in like black and white or something spooky, but he's found like the most boring, terrible, disgusting, like 16, I guess 50 Shades of Grey if you're into books, and 14 Shades of Grey if you're into stained albums, which, you know, I don't know if there are any other measurements of gray, but those are the two I know. But it's just these weird grays and browns and like just gross, awful, stupid shades that just make mm-hmm. you depressed to look at them. And then there's just little tweaks. For example, if you look at the when Brad is eating the cereal in like the bad story or the sad story, it's definitely like a Holt Industries cereal. Or if he's mm-hmm. in the coffee shop, you can see that the logo in the bad one looks like they've sort of messed around with the Starbucks logo, and the menu now no longer reads like mochas and lattes. It now has rainbow sprinkles and worms mm-hmm. and spiders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's even like the ice cream man kind of like tie and smile that we've seen in previous issues. I mean, like we could play spot the ice cream man, you know, I feel like yeah. with a lot of these issues, but I do, that was the place where I was like, oh, this is very prevalent, like in the story overall of like, this is the ice cream man world and it's awful. And there's like nothing these characters could do because that's what the author's going to write.
Yeah. And I would also point out that in terms of continuity, as he's like riding the bus home, I think he sees a plane on fire, you know, mm-hmm. falling through the sky. And I believe that was the last issue of volume 8, but I'm not certain.
Sure.
But
yeah.
Obviously, there was a whole issue about a big issue about that. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, just some little narrative connective tissue there.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing I kind of took away from this issue is this question of like, you know, this author, whether it's W. Maxwell Prince or not, you know, says they want to write these stories, this like this top story of the issue where it's everything's bright and the characters are doing great things and they're happy.
Right.
But I kind of had to beg the question to myself of which is the better comic book to read, right?
Oh, 100%. I went in exactly the same place. I was like, yeah. You could write that story, but it kind of sucks.
It's kind of boring. It's kind of like real life. It's kind of like a crappy rom-com, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that was the point that was trying to be made here of like, this is the more, it's depressing and it's dark and it's going to darker places, but it is the more interesting story to read because it is so far removed from the reality in which we live in a lot of the media that we're already consuming. So I did like that. I liked, you know, that I got to reflect a little bit on that.
Yeah. No, that was exactly my takeaways. It was almost like this issue was like an apologetics where he's like, you know, people complain, but and I could give you that. Here it is. Are you really sure this is what you want? Is this what you want? Yeah. And on the same side, in the same vein, there's almost like an irony to this issue, and I'm sure someone will say that's not irony. this whole idea of, well, I want to write these stories, and I could write these stories, you know, if I tried, mm-hmm. and yet, despite saying like, oh, this is something I could do, or maybe it would be possible one day, but I just can't do it. Like in the end, he does unintentionally basically write that story anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is kind
but
of
again,
like, okay.
I think the purpose is to show that there is a more interesting story to be told. And it is the kind of story that this author tends to write, which I thought was a great way to round off the issue. So,
yeah.
Yeah, let's move on to issue 34. This is Two Tramps. I the first thing I wrote in my notes is more lore. But a quick summation of this issue would be, you know, this is the story of two train hopping vagrants. I don't know what the proper word is. Unhoused people who basically live their lives kind of on a train. They just travel the world, or travel the United States at least, on the train, trying to live peacefully, just without homes, taking what they can from dumpsters, never committing violence, not using drugs really, just trying to live their lives. Sometimes they find a third person and sometimes things go wrong, and that's exactly what happens in this issue. So Nick, curious to hear your thoughts on this next issue.
Yeah, so and I didn't do this for the first issue, so I'll just quickly retroactively say that the title for the first one was The Kind of Story I Want to Write. The question mm-hmm. was, what do you wish was different? And then the kaleidoscope effect was storm clouds and sunshine, which is fitting. This issue, the title is Two Tramps. The question is, what's the craziest thing you ever heard? The kaleidoscope effect page is cans of beans and mice. Yes, it's appropriate that this idea of what's the craziest thing you ever heard is a big ongoing theme. It's the title of the issue. I believe it's actually the first line spoken in the issue. Mm-hmm. I think it even bookends the issue. I think it's also right at the end. And yeah, as you said, it follows these two guys. They've got their own code of ethics. They go around. They, you know, they don't hurt people. They take things. They sort of live this freewheeling lifestyle. but things take an interesting couple twists over the course of these pages. But
The thing I found this issue to almost be kind of peaceful in the first couple of pages, right? Like it just feels like a pretty tame story, all things considered, for Ice Cream Man, right? Like people in a tough spot living a semi-peaceful neutral life, right? Like they understand that they are not necessarily the desired folks. I'm going to put that in heavy quotes there for a lot of people in the world that they live in, but they try to keep to themselves, right? And of course, as soon as they bring in a third guy, you know, with this question at the center of the issue of what's the craziest thing you ever heard, that's when things really start to like branch off into the typical kind of Ice Cream Man, oh shit, this is what's happening. I think the difference here is that this issue, like I said, started pretty peacefully compared to, you know, we open on two people doing heroin or smoking crack or something right. like that, which has right. definitely happened right. in this series. I did appreciate that that's not where this issue started, but it does get wilder because that answer of what's the craziest thing you ever heard really cracks open this nut of a question that I think we've had about the series for forever of like, who are Ricardus and Caleb, you know, in the world? And the fact that this other random guy suddenly starts to talk about them really had my mind swirling. Did not think that this is where the issue was going to go, let alone the further twist down the line where this other third person ends up being a freaking like vampire werewolf monster thing.
Right.
I'll let you jump in here before I get too far ahead.
Yeah. I think for me, interestingly, the kind of narrative layout of the first issue of this series kind of parallels into the second issue of this series, this arc rather, which if you look at the first issue, it's kind of an issue of competing narratives, right? It's the competing narrative of the quote unquote good, you know, the good lifestyle for Brad or the bad life for Brad, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in issue 34, you also have kind of this idea of competing narratives. It's this back and forth of, you know, what's the craziest thing you ever heard? And when when the older gentleman, Phil, is asked this, he talks about this idea that if you make it all the way to the West and you go to the beach in Santa Fe, that you can bottle a piece of sunshine, a little shard of sunshine in a jar, and, you know, there's your own little piece of sunshine. And then the younger guy, Mac, he's basically heard that more or less if you know, that there's this creature that roams the rails of Arizona and it feeds on any vagabonds that dare to make the journey, right? Mm-hmm, and so you mm-hmm. have these two different ideas. One is very much rooted in fear, and the other one is very much rooted in like idealism or some sort of journey or kind of like this moment of peace. And I think what they get to later in the issue, and we'll come back to that, is just the question of like, are these competing ideas or can they all be true?
Mm.
And then, of course, this third guy, Vicious Vin, right? They ask him about it, and that's, you know, what you were getting to.
Yeah, I mean, the bit that, you know, Vin talks about of like this whole thing. I mean, I totally just disregarded like all the other details for this issue because I'm solely focused on the Ice Cream Man bullshit of everything where, you know, he's talking about these two beings. One guy's dressed in all white, kind of like a soda jerk or an ice cream man. The other guy is dressed in all black, like a Gary Cooper type. And these two beings, they're in an eternal philosophical battle about, well, I don't know, is what he says, which, of course, is like almost frustrating for me because we kind of already knew this. And I'm like, you son of a bitch, you were about to give us something and you chose not to. And which makes me say, hey, Mike, maybe you need to step back a little bit about this. And I kind of will talk about this more in the next issue. But there is kind of this thought of like maybe what they're actually doing isn't important. It's the influence that they have on the world that's actually the thing that we need to pay attention to. But, you know, I think we've beat that horse quite a bit on this series so far, as we've talked about it in previous volumes of like how Ice Cream Man's influence on the world has definitely changed things for the narrative, because we saw him showing up in the earliest issues of this series. And then as the series has gone on, he's no longer present, but his presence is present, you know? So I don't know. I was just like blown out of my mind because I didn't think that this is where this issue was going. And then, of course, it gets a little out of hand with suddenly this guy, Vicious Vin, has a gun. And, you know, if you show the gun, you got to use it, right?
I mean, he's like, this guy is scary. Like, there is just, I mean, hat off to Martin Morazzo. Like, there is some terrifying, like, facial expressions of this Vin guy. And you know that this guy's, like, going to go off the chain. And he's like, well, I've got a gun. So, you know, let's go rob a liquor store. And of course, it just goes completely south, and they make for the hills and try to, you know, escape back to the train. Where Vin turns out to be, turns out to be, you know, actually the thing that Mac spoke of, that was riding the rails, and he, you know, mortally wounds Phil, but they manage to ride the train all the way to Santa Fe, I think it is.
Yeah, it's somehow the ocean, but also the middle of Arizona. I didn't really understand it, but I think it's a metaphor, man. You're not supposed to think about it, because the final question at the end of this issue is, why does the train look like a dragon? And is riding the dragon a drug term that we're supposed to maybe associate with the story? I don't know. But that's maybe me. I don't know. Maybe I'm looking too deep into this.
Yeah. No, I mean, I absolutely loved the end of this issue. I think, you know, when you've got the sequence where Mac is carrying Phil down to the water, and remember when there was just one set of footprints, and that's because Mac was carrying Phil.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
I mean, all joking aside, it's a beautiful sequence, and he's talking about these different stories, these different ideas. And Mac says, you know, it turns out that everything is real. It don't matter how strange. Mm-hmm. Which inevitably turns out to be true. I mean, we're told three crazy stories. We're told Max about this thing on the rail. We're told Phil's about bottling the sunshine. And we're told Vicious Vin's story, which of course has to do with Rick and Caleb and their impact on the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just this idea that, you know, all of these narratives are actually quote unquote real. And I just love how this issue ends. I think this is one of my favorite issues in terms of just the prose in it, the writing. You know, Max says, the truth is, I didn't know anything about Phil, where he was from, what kinds of things he liked to do, what actually happened to his mom. I don't even know if Phil was his real name. Still, I love that guy. He was my best friend in the whole entire world. You don't have to know someone to love them. And that's great. That could have been the end of the issue. That would have been like perfect.
Yeah.
Instead, there's more.
Yeah, but there's more. Yeah. The one thing before we move on from that scene, what I was really wondering about, like, obviously we're in this surreal, strange world where we're able to bottle a piece of the sun. But at the same time, I couldn't piece together what the reflection on the water was in this issue. Right. Yeah. Like, there's these weird squiggly bars. I mean, I think that's obviously the water and the ocean and stuff. But like, there's something to that. Right. That is intentionally drawn that way. Right. Like, to symbolize something. And I can't really put my finger on what that's trying to say here. I don't know if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, it's also the same thing when he goes to pull the piece of sunshine out of the sky, and it shows like four, you know, smaller, you know, subsequently smaller or subsequently bigger, whichever way you're going, you know, suns. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, is this supposed to be like the reflection of a camera where you get those like four, you know, trailing circles, you know, from the camera, from the reflection in the camera lens? Is this like supposed to be like a lens effect, or is the sun supposed to be just literally getting smaller and turning into this shard because we're in this weird sort of dreamscapey thing where, you know, everything is real, as Max says. So
yeah, it's a really strange, I feel like the end of this issue is very strange, and there's maybe a question of like, are these guys even alive at this point, right? Because the last scene that we get is like this train on the beach, or on the, I guess, on top of a cliff riding next to the ocean. I thought it was on the beach the first time I saw it, but it's a really strange ending, because this kid is riding on the train at the end with Caleb, or a version of Caleb of some capacity. I feel like he looks a little bit different. Maybe I'm just misremembering, but Caleb looks scared or uncertain, you know, which is very much the opposite of all the previous times that we had seen Caleb, where he kind of had this stoic cowboy you know, ness to him. But instead, in the final pages, he's hunched over, you know, putting his hand to his neck, looking kind of worried. And so it's, I don't know, I don't know what to think about the end of this issue, because like there's too many questions. And then, of course, we're forced right into the next one, which is like a bizarre rambling of another man. So I don't know. To wrap this issue up, I don't know, what were your last thoughts on this, Nick?
I mean, first off, I think this is the first time that we really can say, although maybe it's a dream, but I don't think it's that simple, that mm-hmm. Caleb is actually alive. And we've seen characters throughout the other arcs that have the same body type. They've got the same color eyes. I think he's got like this weird sort of orangish hue to them, yeah. if I remember
like
correctly.
Orange brown almost, yeah.
Yeah, and it's very distinctive. And so there have been other characters that have kind of looked like Caleb. I mean, he's very tall, he's very lanky. You know, he's hard to, you know, confuse for another individual.
Yeah.
But we've never really been told outright that those characters were Caleb. So yeah. This is the first time that we actually have Caleb and he's alive, and that's just crazy. And yeah.
And the fact that he's on a train that is being driven by, you know, Ricardus, Rick, whatever you want to call him,
right.
is kind of bonkers, right? Like, I think there is this, maybe the implication here is that, like, you know, this, that Rick is driving the story, driving the narrative, driving things in general. And yeah. Caleb can only hide and kind of keep on the ride until maybe he can find his best moment. I don't know. Maybe that's reaching, but that's pretty much all I do with this series.
I think it's also interesting that when you talk about this train and it having these weird properties and whatnot, like, let's not forget that Ice Cream Man also drove a taxi, and I think that thing ended up in outer space. So
true.
This idea, true. This idea that he's like piloting these vehicles into all sorts of bizarre and weirdo places is not, mm-hmm. this wouldn't be the first time. So
true. Very true. Well, I guess if we're moving on to issue 35, this is the Book of Necessary Monsters. Nick, tell us about this issue.
Oh, boy. I mean, I think this might, as much as I feel like 36 is a bizarro thing that just doesn't fit, in some ways, I think 36 is a better issue than 35. And maybe it's just because 35 is so prose driven. So the basic conceit of 35... which again, is called, the Book of Necessary Monsters. The question is, the question doesn't exist in this book because mm-hmm. the question page doesn't exist. That title page doesn't exist. The title page here actually looks like a normal prose book where it's got all of the copyright credits and whatnot. Kaleidoscope effect does not exist because again, it looks like a prose book with a prose credits page.
Mm-hmm.
We're told that this is the most important book you'll ever read. The author goes on to then tell just how important it is and how many other books that are important to all sorts of different groups and religions and beliefs throughout society. It's more important than those, according to this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that book is called The Book of Necessary Monsters. He describes it as a bestiary of creatures, both unfortunate and unavoidable. And this guy's name is Jacob, and sure enough, he starts, basically intercutting his own narrative, with sequential art. He starts intercutting it with these prose book pages, that almost look like kind of like an Autobahn where they've got a sketched animal and then they've got like sort of a descriptive section underneath that talks more about, you know, what the creature is and what it does and mm-hmm. what it looks like. And this involves such things as the earworm, or the gum dream, shameful memory.
The shameful memory in specific features the little goblin guy that we've seen all throughout the series.
Right. I call him like the Alzheimer's demon or whatever you want to go with. Yeah. Yeah. And we sort of follow him throughout his day as he's going around the house, kind of arbitrarily, but also kind of being spurred on by things that he's seeing, which may or may not be there.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is intercut with more pages of his book.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't know. What did you think of this? I mean, it's a lot of prose, maybe a little too much. I think maybe like a third less would have been
interesting.
Fine.
Really? I actually found the prose kind of fine, right? Because this isn't like a this isn't like a Marvel data page, right? Where like the font is like 10-point font and it's like way too like compact for a page. It's not like a letters page or something. I feel like there was this. It's a nice blend of like being a lot to read, but also not so much that you feel like you're straining your eyes trying to look at it. I feel like this is an interesting issue because it's an extremely unreliable narrator telling us about things that we have and haven't experienced in the Ice Cream Man story, which kind of makes me wonder, like, is any of this real? Is this just the ramblings of a madman? Can we believe the author of this story written by an author who's been unreliable, written by W. Maxwell Prince, right? Like, there's like so many layers of like meta questions that I have about the series just from this one issue, but I found it to be pretty good overall. Like, I liked how it felt like an extreme change of pace from the previous issue, but in a way that didn't make me feel like I was bored, right? Like, I feel like the inner splicing of the story about Jacob running around his house trying to type this book up in various places throughout his home and also getting these little pieces of information was balanced enough that I didn't feel like it was overwhelming, though there were maybe like one or two times where I was like, okay, oh, there's another page of text that I have to read now. Okay. But I don't know. I didn't feel like it was necessarily worse than 36. I feel like 36 is the weakest of the volume. So, but then again, I'm also a huge sucker for all this Ice Cream Man lore. And the fact that Ice Cream Man was in the issue as one of the monsters has me begging all sorts of questions. So, I don't know, Nick. You didn't like this one, is that what I'm hearing?
Like I think for me the pages of his fictional work were interesting. Obviously, there were some that referenced well-known things that we're aware of, and then there were others. I mean, there was one for like the train vampire, which we, you know, literally saw the very issue before, so that was interesting. Mm-hmm. And then there were some for creatures we've, to my knowledge, never ever seen so far, which,
sure.
Again, is that foreshadowing? I don't know. I think this is the one issue, and you find pretty much one of these in every single volume, where W. Maxwell Prince likes to play with some sort of structure and just some like artificial kind of structure and just mess around with it. We saw this like when he did the Christmas issue with the advent calendar.
Yeah.
And sort of like just having kind of like a skeletal pattern to work on. This one being, you know, this fictional Autobahn guide of sorts that he's writing. I wasn't sure what to make of with the actual story of Jacob, which I thought was kind of interesting because when he starts moving around the house, it almost seems like he doesn't even know how he's doing it. Like, he finds himself underneath the house at one point.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't even know how I got here. This is kind of weird. And then, of course, he's being summoned this whole time to go attend dinner. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to be late for dinner, or the food's going to be cold, and I better hurry up. And, of course, he inevitably shows up, and everybody's dead, which was almost, I think, kind of similar to what I think was like the very first issue of Ice Cream Man, where you have the kid who he sort of comes back from, you know, visiting Ice Cream Man's van, you know, and comes back to his home. And I think everybody's dead, right? And he's just sort of sitting around in the house. Right, because that was the whole conceit of the issue, was like, when the ice cream truck goes by, I'm saying truck, ice cream van, what do we call these? Yeah,
you got it, you're good.
Yeah, like when it shows up, all these other kids are there with all their parents, right? And then we're like, well, where are his parents? And he doesn't have any, and he goes home, and there they are sitting at the dinner table dead, which I think is like a weird motif we've now seen a couple times, actually, so.
Yeah, but I think the difference here in this issue is obviously we've got this other narrative going on of like he's writing this book and the book contains things and monsters. But like there's also this question of like his grip on reality seems to be broken. Like you said, like he doesn't know how he got under his house. Suddenly he's just there. I think that's maybe a little bit explained when he's introduced to this monster that he calls like the medicine cabinet. The guy that lives in there, the Sultan that lives in there, you know? So again, this like adds to this furthering of this unreliability of this character, of what they're saying being having any modicum of truth in this fictional world that we've been following things in. So yeah, I don't know. I found that to be interesting, and I feel like revisiting some similar story types isn't necessarily a bad thing, because I think this adds enough of a spin of it where I didn't even immediately think of that first issue. Though I will say that I felt a little underwhelmed by the end of it, because I kind of expected a slightly bigger reveal other than, oh no, the family's dead, you know, because I felt like this issue was maybe building up towards something a little bit more conspiratorial, and instead it was just this guy's a little bit out of his mind. And that's fine. Like, don't get me wrong, I liked the issue. It just felt like there could have been a bigger bang, I think at the end.
Yeah, and also, like, maybe this is exactly what you do to just build suspense or leave people asking, but it's like, how detached is he, and like, why are they dead? Like, did he kill them and they've been there forever, or like, what exactly is it? Were they? I don't know.
They were stung by they were bitten by a spider, right? I think that's the implication here. At least that's what he says, right? There's okay. Clearly some malice there by the character. He's, you know, upset that his wife cheated on him and that she strapped him to a fucking chair. To
the yoga instructor, like, right?
Yeah. So I don't know. But that question is still there, right? Like, that unreliability, like, oh, he says it's spiders, but he's been saying all these different monsters. None of them are true. Well, the exception of the wallpaper woman. So you're like, what's real, what's not? And I think that is what makes this issue to me really, really fun to read, is that murkiness, right? There is no certainty when it comes to this character, because it's hard for us to believe anything unless we have quote unquote, like, stone cold proof, which is a monster showing up. Are we seeing a group of spiders in his attic, or is the group of spiders just his imagination and he wrote it in to be a monster, right? Like, I like this back and forth. It's like, can I believe him, can I not? And I think that made this issue really intriguing for me.
I think for me, and I'm just kind of arriving at this right now, and maybe this is very obvious for other people, or maybe this is just me talking out of my ass, but I think what I kind of take away from the whole story in some ways is that this guy has, this is such an armchair psychology thing here, but like, he's externalized all of these things that are like in his life. And he's like, I've got all these monsters in my life, right? Like, he's like, it's not me, right? It's not me. It's all of these oppressive forces in my life. And there's tons of them. And I can fill a book with all of these different things that are making me lose control of time. And I don't know where I am, or making me late for dinner, or they're ruining my marriage, right? Like, I've got all these monsters in my life and they're doing all these things. And it's like, okay, but maybe some of this is actually you, you know, right? Yeah. Like,
you're the one that has the pill addiction, right? Like, he's the one.
Exactly. Right. So, I think there's some of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think that is a perfect like summation of that. I think the one last thing that I found really interesting is the page before he describes the ever beckoning family, which is his justification for, you know, this monster that exists, right? Because I think that is the kind of like cherry on top of this sundae of he's just externalizing his own problems. Because I think that's like a super accurate read. I do like that the wallpaper in his room had all these eyes suddenly in them throughout the whole issue. They're just like these little weed symbols, or I don't know, like little plant symbols, I should say. And then the final page before we see his last prose piece, they all have eyes and they're all facing towards him. Cause I thought it was just like a decoration, but you can see it clearly on the page. They're all angled towards him. It's really, really cool. But yeah, I think you totally nailed it with that description of it.
And we can now move to 36.
Tell me how you really feel about this issue.
I struggle with what the theme of this issue is. I really struggle with the message of this issue, other than like, don't be a dick, which, you know, there's still plenty of value in that. But so this issue is called Whale Song. The question is, what song do you sing to yourself? And the kaleidoscope effect is, unsurprisingly, whales and rowboats with oars. So how would you encapsulate sort of the core narrative here, the core conceit?
I feel like the basics of this issue are, it almost feels like an alternate dimension Ice Cream Man issue, which is such a bizarre thing to say out loud, because by all means, it hits all of the pieces of like it being dark, it being gloomy, a man in a white shirt shows up. You know, we've seen all these different things. The little kid holding the balloon, he was there in the back and forth issue at the beginning of the volume, you know, but he's a talking puppet and Ice Cream Man has one leg and a mustache and there's a room for improvement, but it's not really important the same way that it was in the previous volume where the room for improvement was there, right? So we follow this guy as he goes to try to save his daughter, who has supposedly been swallowed up by a whale, which I just kind of assumed to be bullshit because that's how these stories usually go. But it turns out to be the truth. He does find her and he gets out. Like it's kind of this weird, like, or I should say he finds her, but it turns out she's been turned into a skeleton and he manages to get out of this place. But there's kind of all of these lingering questions of, what was the point of that issue in some ways? That's how it kind of felt for me. And I really can't piece it together because it seems like this was just truly supposed to be an actual anthology issue. This does not connect to anything. This just has the same motifs that we've seen in a bunch of other things, telling a different story. Let's see how wacky we can go. But it didn't necessarily feel like an Ice Cream Man. There was no sinisterness to the issue that I feel like we see in any of the other completely disconnected from all things. There's at least something sinister at the core of it. This one is just like, I'm a man, I'm going to save my daughter and I'm going to get through this fucked up world no matter what I have to do. And then I do. So I don't know. That was my takeaway from it. Sorry. I also kind of gave a lot of my first points here. So
that's okay. I mean, for me, if there was like an Ice Cream Man theme or like depressing irony to the issue, it's that this guy who claims that his daughter was swallowed whole by this whale, and he thinks that maybe in some sort of idea analogous to either Jonah if you want to get biblical, or mm-hmm. Pinocchio if you want to go Disney, that his daughter is fine and he's just got to get the whale and he'll bring her back. And of course, everybody in this little war for coastal community is like, dude, like, you're crazy. You got to stop doing this. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, he's right. The whale is real. It does exist. It swallows him whole. It turns out that there's a whole community of people living inside this thing amongst all sorts of other weird things, including possibly the Titanic. And
everybody's
so
in bathtubs for some reason.
Everybody is totally nude in bathtubs. And weirdly, it looked like there was one guy who actually looked like Phil from issue 36, but I'm not 34, but I'm not 100% certain it was.
I was thinking the same thing, but he kind of just looks like a scraggly gray-haired man. He didn't necessarily look exactly like Phil. Right. But what interesting
about
that,
he also had a ton of tattoos, and we never saw Phil's arms or anything, so I couldn't really say for sure.
One of his tattoos being like the Ice Cream Man holding out that ice cream cone to you, which I thought was fun. Again, you know, Morazzo puts all these little Ice Cream Man motifs in the background for no one but us, as far as I'm concerned. That's just having fun.
And if you look at the guy who sells him the ore, that guy also has like Ice Cream Man products or Holt Industries products, if you want to call it what it is. But I think if anything else, like the sad or ironic takeaway of this issue is just the fact that, you know, everybody tells him that he's crazy and how could you believe the story about, you know, her being eaten by a whale and all of this. And of course it turns out that tons of people have been eaten by this whale and they're all living inside it and in this community. But guess what? Despite all of these fantastical, wild things that are true and did happen, by the way, your daughter is dead because as the Ice Cream Man pirate says, basically, he's like, dude, like the digestive system of a whale is incredibly crazy. No one's going to survive that.
Yeah. Sort of, right? Like he's kind of bullshitting, because if they all live in the belly of this beast, wouldn't they all be dead, right?
Well, that's the thing, right? Like everybody else is perfectly fine, but of course this guy's daughter is dead. And how did that happen? Did these other people kill her? Who knows?
Yeah, I kind of wonder if this is like supposed to be like a more intentional, just like parallel to the Pinocchio story, right? Maybe there are just pieces of this that I'm not clicking with because I've never actually read the Pinocchio like story itself. I've only ever seen the Disney movie when I was a young child. So, you know, maybe there is something more to this that maybe we're not seeing, because I don't want to judge this issue so harshly that I'm like, I don't know why the hell this is in here, because I feel like that's the wrong question. I think it's, what are we missing that actually kind of draws this to some parallel that Morazzo and Prince are doing with this issue to make it relate to something, because they're clearly referencing something. I just don't feel like I see it, and that's because I'm just not familiar. Because if they're leaning into the Pinocchio narrative, it makes sense. We got a wooden boy, his pet Cricket, who's also technically a cockroach in this volume.
Is Greg the guy from the Kafka issue, yeah, who gets transformed as a human into a bug? Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, yes. I mean, you know, we're touching Ice Cream Man, but I think there's also like another narrative that they're relating to that maybe we're just not seeing. That might be part of it. I don't want to say that's an excuse, because I feel like we should be able to enjoy the issue without that, but I feel like there's a little bit of that, and that's maybe what we're missing here.
Well, I mean, first off, I do want to say this. I think however we feel about this issue fitting into the lore or whatever we think about the narrative mm-hmm. trappings of it, I think visually it may be the best issue in this whole book.
Oh,
one
yeah.
One of the better issues of the whole series. Like the stylized just take that Morazzo has on all of the waves and the water and the whale and just the size of the whale
mm-hmm.
And all the different angles of it. Just Morazzo and Chris O'Halloran just do an amazing job with these seascapes
mm-hmm.
That just look both like stylized and like daunting and crazy all at the same time. You know, the open sea is a scary place, and this book is no different.
yeah.
But there are also some other really great pages. I think this the issue opens on this like kind of like postcard picture of this coastal community
mm-hmm.
By the water, and that looks really, really great too. So like visually, I think it's a great issue. In terms of narratively, I don't know. When I think about, you know, stories like, you know, Jonah, or when we think about like Pinocchio,
mm-hmm.
right? You have this idea that this whale, you know, swallows these people up, but it's like not too late and they survive, or they make it out, or someone rescues them. And like, maybe this story is simply just trying to flip that on its head and just be like, hey, guess what? Like sometimes, like, if it's too late, it's too late. Like,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he talks about not being the best dad. I think at the end, you know, he says something to the effect of, to think you once asked me for a hug and I had the gall to say no. And that's like the end of the fucking issue. And it's like, if this issue is simply trying to say that, like, yeah, you can have this great attempt to, you know, make this rescue and save this person, and in these other stories, you know, it's possible. You know, sometimes it's just not. And, mm-hmm. you know, you should have done things right the first time around. Maybe yeah. there's nothing more to it than that. I don't know.
Yeah. I had that same kind of thought of like, this could just be a story as simple as that. And we maybe need to ask the question of,
yeah.
is this issue reminding us that this series is just a series of strange tales that happen to have a similar motif?
What
right, right?
is the ongoing motif of Ice Cream Man if it is not people fucking up?
I know.
like
sometimes, so, but
if
you're right.
We... Go ahead.
I was going to say, because it's, you're right though, because it's either people are fucking up or Ice Cream Man is kind of nudging the scale a little bit and then they fuck up, right? That's half of the stories in this series.
Like, this story is basically Ice Cream Man showing up and be like, I'm evil and I'm going to ruin your life. And then after several issues, he's like, oh, damn, you guys do that perfectly fine on your own. I don't even need to be here. Peace out.
Exactly. Exactly.
So maybe this issue is nothing more than people fucking up and feeling bad, because, mm-hmm. God, that would be the real ongoing theme.
And that's okay. Book. You know, that's okay.
That's fine. It's visually striking. It's weird. It's a little bit goofier and not as quite intense as some of the other issues.
Right.
Maybe
right.
if anything else, it just serves as kind of a reprieve. Ice Cream Man doesn't actually kill anyone in this issue.
yeah, yeah.
Maybe.
He seems to kind of just really be this guide of saying, like, oh no, this awful thing, this is already here when I got here, you know? I kind of like that. But I guess to wrap things up, Nick, what are your final thoughts on this volume? Any last minute things you could think of before we say goodbye to this volume of Ice Cream Man?
Yeah, I mean, overall, I would just say I think this is a really, really strong volume.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it feels like, whether intentional or not, that it feels like this book is kind of plotted out in arcs, which I know for some people, they're like, Nick, it's a comic book. Of course it's plotted out in arcs. Not this book. It's obviously an anthology. But sometimes when the issues are collected, it feels like there's a resonance between them, and sometimes it feels like there isn't. And for some reason, with this volume, it does feel like things play off of each other a little bit better than some of the other volumes. It had some great issues. I absolutely love the Two Tramps issue. It's one of my favorites. It sort of feels like we're moving in a great direction. It's very positive. I think it's well written. I think it's kind of beautiful. And of course, I did also really enjoy that first issue, which, as you said, is kind of a little like the triptych issue that kicked off everything. So I thought it was great. And it feels like maybe we're moving in a direction of momentum. I think when we look at the appearance of Caleb, and then we also look, I believe, at in the previous volume, I think the last issue was the plane issue. And if I remember correctly, the epilogue to the plane issue was us finding out that Rick was actually on trial in this weird, crazy sort of like bonkers hellscape sort of courtroom. I don't know how to describe it. So maybe between the two, we're headed somewhere.
Yeah. I don't know if I necessarily completely agree with your thought of this being like, I don't know, like it being plotted out in arcs. I understand where you're coming from when you say that, but I will say that I agree that this volume in particular felt like it had a cohesive whole to it. Like, particularly those two middle issues, I think really like connected in a way more than previous volumes have so quickly in succession. But yeah, and I agree with you that issue about the Two Tramps is maybe the best one of the volume. Yeah, but I don't know, my last thoughts are I'm so excited to get more lore. I'm so happy that we actually have seen Caleb, because it means that maybe there's more. If this book runs to 60 issues, then maybe we're at the halfway mark. If it runs to 50, it means that we're just past it, and this could be the beginning of the end one way or another. That makes me very excited and sad at the same time. So, yeah, I don't know. This is a lot of fun, Nick. I appreciate you, as always, going through this bonker series, or convincing me to go with you through this bonker series, I guess. And I don't know. I think I'm excited to see when Volume 10 comes out. We maybe have to get that recorded later this year. So until next time. Comics are good, and so are you.